GAG Headquarters, Galactic City, Coruscant.
What happened to Barrett Sa'i?
Ben asked. Shivu consulted the custody file and shook his head. Not here. No record of transfer to CSF custody either.
But every prisoner should be logged in and out, right?
Right. Shivu stared at his data pad, lips compressed in a thin line. I don't like prisoners who disappear. He managed to smile at Ben. Maybe he was repatriated and nobody logged him out. We sent back a lot of Krillians in a hurry before the blockade.
Yeah.
It's hard when you get personally involved, said Shivu quietly. Best to stand clear and do everything by the book.
Jason doesn't.
Colonel Solo is my commanding officer. It wasn't an answer that made any sense on the surface, but Ben was learning fast. Shivu was saying that he wouldn't give an opinion on Jason's behavior, whatever he thought of it. He was angry about Aelin Haber. Ben was distressed too. Jason was all he wanted to be, and then suddenly, he killed a prisoner. Carelessly, not in anger, but she was still dead. And Ben wasn't sure he knew him as well as he thought he did.
Is this what I want to be?
I understand, said Ben, and went off to the now empty gymnasium to practice his lightsaber skills with the remote as a target. The small sphere danced and spun in the air as he swung and sliced, leaving a faint trail of light behind the blue blade with each stroke. When he became swept up in the movement and stopped concentrating, he always found himself on the edge of one perfect movement after another. It didn't feel like a series of actions, it felt like one. His first and last stroke, frozen and repeated over and over again. There came a point as he pursued the darting silver sphere when his mind was completely blank. Not just clear, blank. And in those moments, he saw things. It was as if his conscious mind had stopped its relentless chatter and left a door wide open. Then his mind wasn't pure white light any longer, but a detailed image with layers of data that he could understand intuitively, but not read. It stopped him dead in his tracks. The remote responding to him froze in midair. Jason was summoning him. The remote presence of other Jedi was something he had grown up with, the way other kids heard parents calling them. But this was different. He was being summoned, not called. It was an order. He felt it. He retrieved the remote and ran to find Jason. He could locate him easily these days, as if Jason had an overwhelming presence in the Force, like a signpost when he wanted it. Sometimes, though, he disappeared completely. Ben really wanted to learn to do that. Jason was sitting in one of the administration offices, staring at a holomap on the wall with his hands cupped over his mouth and nose, as if he was thinking about something that upset him.
Jason?
Ah, Ben. I wasn't expecting you to come so quickly. I hope I didn't interrupt anything. Like he had any choice. But Jason always treated him like an adult.
Just lightsaber drill.
I'm looking at the areas we have to sweep now. We've got running battle going on between Atzeri and Coruscanti in the lower levels, according to CSF. And the bomb disposal teams are investigating 10 more suspicious packages. We deal with one problem, and another 3 spring up in its place.
What did you want me for?
Jason indicated a chair and motioned Ben to sit down. It's time I gave you more responsibility. We only grow when we're given the chance to. Ben tried to imagine what extra responsibility he could be given. He had already gone on anti-terror operations and sabotaged weapons that could destroy whole worlds. It was hard to top that when you were 13. You can detect weapons and explosives. You're really good at it. Jason jerked his thumb in the direction of the holomap on the wall. Go on. See if you can sense anything by looking at the map. Ben jumped out of the chair and scanned the map. Like most holomaps of Galactic City, it was multi-layered, and he could peel away levels of each grid or dive deep into them by touching the light grid with his finger. He passed his hand above the surface to concentrate on the Force and found nothing. Perhaps it wasn't on that section of the map. He tapped his finger against the far left of the display, and the map shifted west to take him farther from the Senate building and toward the business districts. He found himself drawn to a quadrant a few kilometers southwest of the Senate, but he sensed nothing specific.
In there somewhere.
Good. Jason stood right behind him and put his hand on his shoulder. Normally that was reassuring, but right then, Ben had a sudden memory of Aylin Haber. Go on.
Something's about to happen.
Ben felt he was being tested.
Do you feel it?
Yes, I do. And the World Brain's ferals report activity there.
What is it, then?
I want you to work this one out for yourself as part of your training. I'll be there to help you out if you need it, but I think it's time you learn to make decisions. I trust you. For a few moments, Ben was wildly excited at the trust Jason was placing in him. Then he lapsed back into being torn between fear of failing and remembering Aylin Haber. Do you trust me, Ben? Jason asked suddenly.
Of course I do.
Tell me the truth. Jason could sense everything. Sometimes he seemed almost telepathic. Ben knew there was no point lying to him, and he didn't want to. He wanted answers.
Okay, I don't understand how you could hurt that woman so badly, he said. You're not a bad person. You don't like violence. It scares me, because I don't think I could ever do that. And that means we're different. And I wanted to be just like you, and now I'm not sure.
Jason didn't look upset or offended. It was hard to tell how he had taken the admission. I can understand that, he said quietly. And we all have to find out for ourselves how far we can go and what we're prepared to do. You won't know until you have to do it. Ben wasn't sure that he understood, but he knew he had to go through with this. It couldn't be that different from what he'd been doing for the last couple of weeks. He knew what he could do and what he wasn't prepared to do. He was certain of that. New black GAG assault vessels, CSF ships in new livery, were waiting for them at the landing pad. Captain Shivu leaned out of the troop bay of the lead ship, hanging on one of the overhead straps with one arm. Quadrant H-90's not secure yet, he told Jason. They've barricaded the skylane intersections with speeders. Jason jumped into the bay and hauled Ben aboard. Are they still in position? CSF wants a bit of backup before they move. There seem to be a lot of Coruscanti involved. Jason frowned. You sure? Sure. Not every taxpayer here seems to agree with the Alliance line. Ben pondered that as they rose into the air and banked left to head for H-90. It was an ordinary neighborhood as far as he knew. Shops, bars, apartments, and a market, with a cosmopolitan population. Jason and Shivu shouted a conversation above the noise of the drives that filled the open bay. It started when CSF arrested someone for painting anti-government slogans on the local Galactic City Authority offices, sir. There's a full riot squad deployed now. Any more incidents? Shivu paused and put his hand to his ear, concentrating on his comlink earpiece. 20 public order arrests. No serious casualties. Pretty quiet. Worse to come, though, Ben? Jason asked. Ben nodded. Yes. I think that's a safe bet any day of the week, said Shivu. The assault ship swooped low over a skylane that was clogged with speeders of all sizes at each intersection. CSF vessels had formed up behind them at a careful distance. The focus of the activity was an apartment block, where a noisy protest was taking place. The crowd along the walkways looked like a complete cross-section of species, and when the GAG ship dived lower to observe, it was met with jeers and obscene gestures. The ship lifted higher and hovered above the CSF line until a speeder bike rose to meet it. The sergeant astride it flipped up his visor as he drew level with the bay.
Tip off that they might be hoarding weapons somewhere. We're deciding whether to go in and search the area and risk a full-scale armed riot, or wait until they got bored and go home.
Jason, Ben, and Shivu surveyed the scene from a safe height. Want us to go in? Jason asked. We don't have to worry about community relations like you do.
Yeah, I heard that, the sergeant said warily.
A chant rose up beneath them.
The Empire's back! The Empire's back!
Once Ben was physically close to the area, he could feel much more specific disturbances in the Force, little whirlpools of threatening darkness. He felt something else now.
It's big weapons.
We were kind of hoping for small ones, but...
Ben could feel a growing anxiety that was almost like itching deep in his ears. So deep that it nearly touched the back of his throat.
I know where they are, he said.
He looked to Jason to confirm his feeling. Jason just looked at him, waiting.
What do you think?
What do you think? Asked Jason. Your call.
It feels really dangerous.
So decide. Do we go in or not? Ben wavered.
If I'm wrong, we might start a full riot and people might get killed.
Shifu powered up his blaster. The faint whine cut through the rumbling voices and throb of her pulsers.
Ready when you are, sir.
You have to make the decision, Ben, Jason said. You have to decide what you think is right based on the intelligence you have now, and then stand by your actions. Ben hesitated. He wasn't sure now if Jason would stop him if he thought he was mistaken. He had to make his move.
That block, there,
said Ben, pointing down at a stack of apartments over a scruffy restaurant.
Take us in.
Although Ben was sure, almost sure, that he could deal with blaster fire or missiles hurled at him, he was scared. The crowd below loomed larger, some turning and running away as the assault ships closed in, some rushing toward the vessels. At 10 meters, Ben jumped, using the force to stop him smashing into the walkway. People scattered. He heard Jason thud down behind him, and he didn't look back as he ran for the door of the restaurant. Black-suited GAG troopers passed him and secured the doorway, and Ben drew his lightsaber, simply because he was operating on blind instinct now. There was nobody in the restaurant. The tables were empty, and he ran between them, heading for a door at the back. Behind him, he heard shouting, screams, and blaster fire. He had to be right about this now. He stopped at the doors at the back, not sure whether to force them open, and saw it was Shifu behind him, not Jason, covering his back, blaster aimed. Ben opened the doors with a force push and stepped through, saber held in both hands, and found himself in the kitchens, a jumble of Durasteel racks, ovens, and sinks flanked by cupboards and storerooms. He concentrated, trying to feel for where people or arms might be hidden, and went instinctively toward a hinged door with a hand wheel on one side. He didn't sense a person, but he sensed something indefinably dangerous. Shifu pointed to the hand wheel, indicating get over on that side by stabbing his finger. Then he made a circling motion. Turn the hand wheel. Ben held his lightsaber in his right hand and slowly wound the wheel with his left. The door hissed as a seal broke and a mist of chilled air tumbled out into the warm kitchen. Shifu held up two fingers, then one, and jerked his fist down. 3, 2, go! Ben wrenched the door open and Shifu aimed inside. It was pitch black, and the blaster's targeting spotlight punched into the darkness of a cold store, highlighting mist. Ben fumbled for the lights. Frost-rimed boxes lined shelves. Unidentifiable joints of meat hung from hooks. Nobody was hiding in there. Ben covered Shifu as he rummaged around in the cold store. The captain emerged with a long metal cylinder in one hand. His helmet was already iced over.
Know what this is? He asked.
Ben stared at the object. It was a tube.
Grenade launcher?
Close. Shoulder launcher, for small missiles. Part of one, anyway. There's about a dozen in there.
That shouldn't be on the menu.
Griffing right, it shouldn't be.
Okay. Let's go up one floor,
Ben said.
That's your force sense talking, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Works for me.
The turbo lift was tiny as they huddled inside. Ben hated lifts. It was the moment when the doors opened that was the worst. His force sense would tell him if there was a welcoming committee outside, but he still had a sick feeling in his stomach as the doors parted and he saw into the lobby beyond for the first time. This time he was sure there were people around. He pointed to the left. Shifu darted down the passage and trained his blaster on the first door, gesturing Ben to stand to one side as he blew the lock panel. Then Ben sent a surge of energy ahead of him and a shockwave to flatten anyone inside. Like a stun grenade, it provided a few precious seconds to overpower an enemy, but it didn't leave them temporarily deaf and blinded. The two men inside, and Ben had spotted them only when he was well inside the room, scrambled up from the floor, and he lunged forward with his lightsaber. His reflexes took over. A blaster bolt shot past him. He thought it was from Shifu's weapon. And as he saw one of the men raise his arm, he brought the saber down in an arc. It felt like the skirmish was taking forever, but he knew somehow that it was seconds. Another bolt of white light flared, and and he deflected it without thinking. Then there was silence. The air in the room smelled of burned fabric and rasped at his throat. He could feel his pulse pounding in his temples.
Well, they're about as dead as you can get.
Shifu still held his blaster on two men as he stared down at them.
Why did you block my shot like that?
Did I?
You did.
But you shot one.
No, one of them fired at me.
Ben looked at his hands as if they weren't his. He was holding the lightsaber two-handed as usual, and his grip was shaking. He killed both of the men. They both looked about Jason's age, and he didn't like what he saw.
Were they both armed?
Ben asked.
Bit late to worry about that.
Shifu squatted down, laid his blaster beside him, and began searching the bodies.
Well, one definitely was.
Can't find a weapon on the other.
Force, forgive me. I killed them. I killed a man who wasn't armed. Didn't even think.
Ben leaned against the wall and slid down a little, bracing his legs. Around him, more GAG troops were running down passages, checking rooms. He heard cupboards being wrenched apart and shouts,
"In here! Clear!"
His head sank into his hands. He wanted to look, but he couldn't. Someone took his arm. "Ben, get up." It was Jason.
"I'm sorry."
"Ben, get a grip. You've got work to do." Jason pulled him upright gently, but firmly. "Go on, look. You should have searched the bodies instead of leaving it to Shifu."
"He wasn't armed."
"Stop it. His buddy was, and the place is stuffed with rocket launchers and hardware." Jason steered Ben toward the two men on the floor and held him by both shoulders from behind to make him face them. Ben switched off. He felt a numbness spread through his mind, and all he saw was shapes. He didn't see people. He knew he would later, but right now, something had cut in to cushion him from what he was seeing. "You made the call, Ben." Jason's voice was low. From the corner of his eye, Ben could see Shifu watching, or at least he was facing in their direction, head turned as if he was focused on them. "Mostly we get it right, but sometimes we don't. You got most of it right today. Maybe you got all of it right, but it might take us days to find out if that man was a threat or not. Either way, you can't afford to let it get to you." He turned Ben toward the door, and one of the GAG troops took his arm and led him out into the passage. The noise outside was leaking into his awareness. He felt the force torn and twisted by a riot in progress. He'd started it. It was all his doing. He caught a snatch of conversation.
"He's a kid," Shifu's voice.
"He's a boy."
"He's a Jedi and has to learn," Jason said. "He was already handling weapons at the same age you were learning to add." Ben took a breath and surrendered himself to blind reflex again. By the time he got out onto the walkway, CSF officers were using snare rifles on parts of the crowd that wouldn't disperse, and the air was hazy with smoke. The thrum of assault ship drives made his back teeth vibrate. A CSF officer grabbed him and bundled him into one of the police personnel carriers, and he sat with his back against the bulkhead, silent and stunned, until a familiar face appeared in the hatchway with his visor pushed back.
"Hey, Ben,"
said Corporal Lakoff. "You okay?"
"Kind of."
"It's never easy, kid."
"What isn't?"
"Killing someone. You need someone to talk to? I'm here, anytime."
Ben knew he should get out of the carrier and get back to fighting, but a small, scared voice inside said that he was only a kid. It wasn't fair. He wanted his mom. He shook himself out of it. Mandalorian boys his own age would already be warriors. They'd spit on Ben for being such a baby. He pulled himself to his feet and scrambled out of the personnel carrier, stumbling back down the walkways as if wading through deep snow. At some point, and it was probably only moments later, Jason caught his arm and passed him to Shifu. They were pulling out. The black assault ship drew level with the walkway, and Shifu heaved Ben aboard. On the flight back to base, Ben sat sandwiched between Shifu and Jason, thinking that if they moved, he'd just collapse.
"It doesn't get any easier," Jason whispered. "The day it gets easy is the day you have to stop this business."
Ben found his voice somehow, and it didn't sound like his own. It echoed in his head.
Will you teach me to shut down my presence in the Force, Jason?
Why? His instinct was that it would protect him one day. He also had another reason.
So if I want Dad not to find me, I can.
You can't hide from your father every time you do something he doesn't approve of.
I know, but I just want to be on my own sometimes. Really on my own.
Jason studied his face as if looking for something.
You did okay today, Ben. You don't have to hide.
Third Fleet Base, Coruscant.
Jaina arrived, still wearing her orange flight suit, and sat down in the chair beside Luke with slow care.
Thanks for coming.
I wanted to hear your side of it. I don't believe Jaina Solo would ever turn tail and run during an engagement.
I'm suspended from duty.
What happened?
I didn't think it was appropriate to continue attacking a civilian vessel when it was retreating.
Luke knew the answer, but he asked anyway. Who ordered you to do that?
Jason.
Had the ship fired on Alliance vessels?
No, but it breached the exclusion zone, and it had targeted Jason. I took out its aft laser cannons, but it was still capable of firing. Then it withdrew from the exclusion zone, and Jason ordered me to open fire on it.
Up to that point, Jaina had been detached and professional, couching everything in military terms. Then her frown deepened.
It was just wrong, Uncle Luke. He wanted destruction. He wanted to teach them a lesson. I felt it.
Luke chewed over the complexities of rules of engagement. Technically, the freighter was a proven threat. It could still attack Alliance ships, even if it had moved outside the exclusion zone. Technically, Jason was right. Had it not been Jason, Luke would have chalked it up to the split-second decisions people had to make in battle and accepted it sadly. But it had been Jason's order. One more incident that showed Luke how far toward the dark side his nephew had moved. The Jason he had known was gone, and Lumaya was around. She was back, and that boded ill. She was here. He'd have to find her.
You have to get Ben away from Jason, said Jaina, unprompted.
I know, Luke said. I'm trying to get him to make that choice for himself. If I force it, I'll make Jason a martyr in his eyes.
Am I wrong to think this about my own brother?
What do your senses tell you?
That he's going to somehow break my heart one day.
Yes, said Luke.
We need to make sure that never happens.
But it already has, he thought. It already has.
The Solo's apartment, Coronet Corellia.
You gotta hand it to Gedgen, said Han. He must have had all this planned.
Fett had already worked out a fast exit from the Solo's shabbily anonymous apartment. From the window, he could see the red flashing lights of Corellian Security Force speeders racing across the city. When he checked his bank account, one of them anyway, he was already 1 million credits better off. Gedgen certainly paid promptly. Myrta gave Han a wary look.
Forget Gedgen. Call your son.
Leia Solo had a comlink pressed to one ear.
I'm trying.
She stared at the comlink in exasperation and then snapped it shut.
He's not answering.
Let's try the Jedi way. That usually gets his attention. She clasped her hands in front of her and closed her eyes for a moment.
You doing some of that Jedi mind stuff?
Myrta demanded. Leia opened her eyes and didn't look amused.
I'm reaching out to my son in the Force to make him realize I need to talk to him. He'll know it's me.
On the wall, a holoscreen showed a harassed-looking news anchor relaying the news that the president had been assassinated. The deputy president, Vol Barad, suitably respectful, paid tribute to Sal Solo and said that an emergency meeting had been called with leaders of all the political parties to work out a way forward.
First time he's been allowed out in public since Thrakken came to power, said Han. He must think this is his lucky day.
Myrta had started pacing up and down the apartment, now watching both the doors and the windows. Leia opened her comlink.
Try again.
Thrakken said there were still other assassins out there, Han said quietly.
Fett shrugged.
Not now they know he's dead.
You sure?
If they're not gonna get paid, Why would they want to kill you?
Han frowned slightly.
I suppose that's bounty hunter logic.
Then Leia said,
Jason, Jason, this is urgent.
And the room fell silent. Fett killed the audio on the holoscreen.
Jason,
said Leia,
Thrakken's dead. Don't ask. No, ask your father about that. Aelin,
Myrta interrupted.
Ask him about Aelin.
Leia nodded emphatically.
Jason, this is important. You said you arrested a bounty hunter called Aelin Haber. Your father did a deal about Thrakken. No, listen, Jason. I need you to listen. Now Thrakken's dead. The woman isn't a threat, and her father wants to see her very badly. Jason?
Fett felt sweat beating on his top lip, despite his helmet's environment controls.
Jason, repeat that?
Leia's gaze fixed in mid-distance, and then flickered, as if she'd heard a reply she wasn't expecting.
Jason, her father is Boba Fett.
Whatever Jason had said, Leia was having problems understanding it. She closed the comlink and ran one hand over her hair, not quite looking at him or Myrta.
I'm sorry,
she said.
I don't know how to tell you this, but Aelin Haber died under interrogation.
Fett told himself that he didn't care about anything or anybody, and that Aelin was a stranger, but it was a lie. The fact that he had last seen her as a baby and that she had tried to kill him didn't change a thing right then. She was his daughter. He was dying, and he wanted to see her. He looked at Myrta Gave, and she stared back at him, and her face was stricken. There was no other word for it. Then she leveled her blaster at him. Instinct made him reach for his, and the next thing he saw was a streak of white fire coming at him almost in slow motion, and Leia Solo reaching out both hands as if she could seize the very energy with them. Myrta's blaster flew high in the air and clattered across the tiled floor. Myrta fell back against the wall hard as if she'd been thrown against it. Leia stood over her, but the girl just stared past her at Fett, defiant but pinned down by the Force. The air stank with the ozonic smell of a discharged blaster. Fett had his EE-3 trained on Myrta, but Han noticed that it was slowly lowering to his side. I want to know what all that was about, Leia said, as if Myrta were just a naughty kid who hadn't done her homework, rather than a bounty hunter who tried to take a shot at Boba Fett. Myrta's eyes brimmed. Han hadn't thought of her as the crying kind. Maybe it was a very big bounty she'd just lost.
I was delivering him to her,
she indicated Fett with a contemptuous jerk of her chin.
She wanted to kill him for certain this time.
Fett didn't say a word. He slung his blaster rifle over his shoulder with a slow, deliberate movement, and stood the way he often did, hands a little away from his sides, weight on one foot, as if he was going to whip out one of his astonishing array of weapons.
But why shoot him? Now that she can't pay you, what's he... He ran out on his wife and baby, that's why. Yes, the great Boba Fett didn't have the guts to stand by his family. He left her, and she had to bring up Aelin on her own. And she died because he wasn't there being a proper husband and father. If she couldn't kill him, then I will.
Leia crouched over her. Tears were streaming down the kid's face now, and Fett was absolutely still.
Why? What has he ever done to you?
Myrta gulped in air, choking back sobs. Han resisted the urge to play dad and comfort her.
Because she was my mother, and I promised her that he'd die. That's why. So he's my grandfather, in name anyway.
She rounded on him, scrambling to her feet.
You didn't know that, did you? You didn't know because you didn't care. You never even tried to find out what happened to Aelin until now. And now it's too griffing late for us all. 50 years. 50 years.
Han would remember this for years to come and still not believe it. Fett's shoulders heaved visibly, as if he was taking a deep breath. He still said nothing. It was a lousy way to be reunited with family. Han almost felt sorry for him. Myrta stood staring into the mask of his helmet, as if she could see the man behind it. Then she punched both fists into his chest plate as hard as she could, face contorted with grief and rage, and knocked him back a couple of paces. He just took it. She punched as hard as she could, and Fett let her, until Han saw that her knuckles were bleeding, and he decided she'd had enough. He grabbed her shoulders and pulled her back. Fett still hadn't said a word.
Hey, come on, come on.
Han held Myrta until she stopped struggling.
It's okay, kid, it's okay. Take it easy.
Her mother was dead. Okay, she was a contract killer, but that wasn't the girl's fault. He caught Leia's eye and could see that she was horrified. Whatever Jason had said that he hadn't heard had upset her. Maybe the detail was too graphic to share.
Fett, don't you have anything to say to this kid? She's your family.
He's not!
Fett simply turned to Han. His voice was as flat and unemotional as ever.
I want Aelin back. I want her body.
Leave that to me, said Leia.
Han patted Myrta's back. She was shaking now.
You two better sort yourselves out fast. He's all you've got, Myrta,
Leia said quietly.
Trust me. However bad things are, your family is all you have in the end.
Han thought it was high time he and Leia worried about their own skins. Could they live on Corellia openly now? He picked up his comlink to call Dur Gedain, but he stopped as Fett suddenly took off his armor plates, chest and back, and dumped them on the chair. He held his arms at his sides.
Pick up your blaster, Myrta Gave.
Leia moved as if to stop her.
No. Let her do it.
And the kid did. She bent down and took the blaster in both hands and held it level, right hand grasping the grip, left cupped beneath to steady the shot, and aimed at Fett. She was deadly calm now. Fett reached up slowly and lifted off his helmet. He was gray and scarred and hard. It was the first time Han had ever seen his enemy's face. It was far less than he had imagined, and all the more shocking for that. It was a face that was as unfeeling as a slab of rock. They said your life was etched in your face over time, and Fett's life must have been utterly cold, brutal, and alone.
Go on,
said Fett. He was staring straight at his granddaughter.
Do it.
Myrta wasn't crying now.
I said do it.
She held her aim for a count of five and then lowered the blaster. Then she sat down on the battered sofa, blaster on one knee, fingers still tight on the grip. If Han had expected a tearful reconciliation, he had the wrong family. Fett's ice water blood definitely ran in her veins. Leia watched warily as if she was expecting Myrta to change her mind. Fett replaced his armor and stood by the window again, watching the police activity in the city beyond, blaster at his side. Leia broke the silence.
Now everyone's calmed down. I'll talk to Jason again. We'll arrange to recover the body, and then you can leave.
She walked out into the kitchen and Han followed, wondering if he'd hear blaster fire the second his back was turned.
When did you become Fett's best buddy?
He whispered.
Remember that little vacation I spent encased in carbonite thanks to him? Okay, so we saved the day when the bong.
Han, I don't know how to tell you this, but I think it's going to be Fett who bears the grudge.
She stared at the comlink as if she dreaded talking to their son again.
Jason killed Fett's daughter. Personally.
Yeah?
Han lowered his voice still further.
That's the idea. She was going to kill us.
He killed her while he was interrogating her.
Han had to think about that for a couple of seconds. Jason was more of a stranger with every passing day. But he didn't kill prisoners. He couldn't. Only monsters did that kind of thing. Jason couldn't be a monster. He was his boy, his sweet kid.
No.
I think he tortured her, Han.
Chief of State's Office, Senate Building, Coruscant.
Well, said Cal Omis, where does this leave us?
Senator Cassil rubbed his forehead with one hand, and Jason watched him carefully. Luke, in turn, watched Jason.
This wasn't our doing, Cassil insisted. The intelligence service definitely had no hand in assassinating Sal Solo.
We still have agents in Coronet, though?
Of course we do, but it's still not our handiwork. We wouldn't be so stupid as to hand Corelli a free pass to recruit other planets to its cause.
We're not being believed, Luke said slowly. Omis looked exhausted.
People believe what they want to believe. So who do we have to deal with now? Who's really running the show in this multi-headed beast of a coalition cabinet?
Dur Gedgen, Jason said. And he came to my parents before Sal Solo was killed, with a suggestion that a regime change might be on the cards. Omis looked to Luke as if expecting some input.
What does intelligence have to say about him, then? I can just about remember his father in the Human League days.
Don't expect him to disarm any faster than Sal Solo, said Gasil. Forget the assassination, except as an accelerant to finding Corellia more allies. The overall situation hasn't changed.
Where's Nyarthal got to, by the way?
Jason looked up. She's on her way. She's being briefed by the commanders. The blockade was biting. Corellia could feed itself, but for everything manufactured, it relied on its orbiting industrial stations, which were now mostly cut off by Alliance pickets. Jason considered how he could get Aelin Haber's body to Corellia. Are you with us, Jason? Luke asked. Jason jerked back to the here and now, caught unawares for once. Apologies, just considering logistics. The Jedi Council feels that we should open formal talks with the new Corellian government and offer them a way out.
They'll turn it down.
Nothing's lost by offering, said Luke. Do we need Senate agreement to do that?
Technically,
Omis replied.
But seeing as over 100 planets have withdrawn their representatives in protest now, I think we can assume that those left wouldn't object if we did.
Luke seemed to be optimistic about the prospects of a breakthrough, even if his expression was grim. Why would Gedgen and his cronies want to remove Thraken if they didn't want a change of policy? No better time to remove a rival than under the cover of war, said Jason. It probably has nothing to do with disarmament, and everything to do with old, festering resentments. Omis interrupted.
Gentlemen, if the new Corellian administration refuses to disarm, then we have no choice but to formalize a state of war. That changes the legality of the situation, and gives us different laws to deal with matters.
More powers. Luke's voice was almost a whisper.
More emergency powers, said Omis.
He stood up and began collecting flimsy sheets from his desk. It was the diplomatic way he indicated to any meeting that the talking was over, and now he was going to do something.
I'm going to make a formal approach now to the new Corellian administration and offer them talks on disarmament,
Omis said.
Maybe we'll all get a surprise. Maybe the blockade made them see sense.
Jason turned to Luke, at least to take his leave of him courteously. But Luke walked past him with a formal nod of the head and left. Jason accepted it as part of the price he was paying. He opened his comlink and called C-3PO. 3PO. The droid at least always greeted him as if he was pleased to hear from him. Has R2 finished repairing the Falcon? Tell him to hurry up then. I'm flying her back to Dad.
Coronet City, Spaceport.
Bed occupied himself with carrying out panel checks on Slave One and tried not to think about the fact that he had lost a daughter and acquired a granddaughter in a matter of a day. This was why it made sense to live alone. Families, wives, and kids were painful. They got in the way. Myrta was, as far as he knew or cared, still at the Solo's apartment. How had she fooled him for so long? He couldn't believe he hadn't worked out who she was. But if you hadn't seen your daughter for more than 50 years, there was no reason to recognize her daughter.
You have a family. Like it or not, you have a family.
Now he waited for Goran Bavin to shake down his network of contacts and tell him what Leia and Han Solo either didn't know or didn't want to tell him.
Mandalore,
said the comlink. Fett pounced on it.
Bavin, what have you got for me?
I'm very sorry about Aelin, Bobica.
I don't want your sympathy. I need intel.
Aelin was being held by Jason Solo.
I know that, but who was interrogating her?
Like I said, Jason Solo.
I'll kill him. This had better be accurate.
Mandalore,
said Bavine.
This comes from the Coruscant Security Force. Some still think well of Mandalorians, thanks to your father's friends.
I want to know everything.
Jason Solo is a regular little Jakar.
I take it that's bad.
He uses Jedi techniques that don't quite fit their peace and justice image. Apparently one of his officers was complaining that he uses the Force to beat answers out of prisoners without laying a finger on them.
Go on.
They say he killed Aelin with the power of his mind.
Bavine swallowed audibly.
Just say the word, and we'll find him.
Not necessary.
You're going after him yourself, then?
Aelin was a bounty hunter. She knew the risks.
Bobaka, you can't mean that.
I ought to, but I don't. It hurts. It doesn't hurt as bad as losing Dad, but it hurts somehow. Forget Jason Solo. Leave him to me.
Corellian Exclusion Zone, Millennium Falcon inbound.
Jason would have been happier flying alone, but with Thrak and Sal Solo dead, there was no longer a reason for keeping C-3PO and the Nogri away from his parents. Corellia knew the Solos were back.
Millennium Falcon, this is Alliance Warship Revival. You're approaching a total exclusion zone. Alter your course 90 degrees. I repeat, your course is taking you into a military exclusion zone, and we will open fire if you proceed.
Oh dear, said C-3PO. Master Jason, do be careful.
Relax, I can handle this. Jason switched to an open channel. Revival, this is Colonel Jason Solo of the Galactic Alliance Guard.
Your transponder is showing as the Millennium Falcon, a Corellian-registered vessel.
Apologies, Revival. He sent an encrypted identification code to the warship's comm officer. I have a rendezvous to make within Corellian space. They won't fire on the Falcon now that Sal Solo is gone.
We weren't advised of this, Colonel.
It's a classified operation. Put me through to your commanding officer, and I'll have him verify it.
Won't be necessary, sir. Just identify yourself clearly on your return.
I'll be back in a different ship. Don't be too quick to open fire, will you? He steered through the line into the exclusion zone that had trapped an orbiting ring of industrial stations and fleet bases in limbo, cut off from contact with Corellia itself and from outside supply lines. When Jason crossed the planet-side limit of the exclusion zone, he switched to the civilian transponder, looking to any ground-based traffic control like one more small ship that had beaten the blockade. Lots did. They just didn't make much of a difference to the overall supply situation, that was all. Once clear, he took up station at the rendezvous point and went aft to the cargo bay for a final check on Aelin Vel's body bag, lying in the conservator on a repulsor gurney. C-3PO trotted along behind him, all anxiety.
Allow me, Master Jason.
Jason held up his hand to the droid in a polite refusal of help. It's okay, 3PO. I'll do it. His parents' shuttle came alongside the Falcon and docked with her cargo hatch. Leia was first into the bay, and although her first move was to hug him, it felt formal, distant, as if she was holding back. His father trailed behind, looking broken. There was no other word for it. He made no attempt to embrace him.
Aye.
Han glanced past him at C-3PO. He didn't normally take that much notice of the droid.
Aye, 3PO. Are the Nogri with you?
Jason ignored the snub. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. What did you say at times like this? Yes, they're in the cabin. Have you heard from Jaina?
No.
Leia cut in. You want to tell us something? No, she's fine. Not flying combat missions. I'm sure Zek's keeping an eye on her. Is there anything else you want to tell us, Jason? Leia was talking to him as if he were a kid who'd done something terrible. Anything at all? What exactly? Han sighed with a roll of the head that always told Jason he was in trouble.
Son, we're collecting a corpse from you. That should give you a clue.
She was hired to kill you. She never got the chance. Jason opened the conservator hatch, and cold air rolled out. He indicated the large black bag lying flat on the Durasteel gurney. What more is there to say? Han now stood between him and his mother.
I need to know what happened for my own sanity.
Leia scratched one brow, clearly embarrassed.
I think we both need to know, Jason. Okay, Dad. I was interrogating her, and she died. Do you really want to know the details?
It kind of makes a difference, Jason.
I used a mind invasion technique to make her talk. She must have had some physical weakness. She died of an aneurysm. Can we take a look?
Leia asked.
We have to hand her over to Fett. We don't want any surprises.
Jason hauled out the gurney, then opened the bag down its gription seam.
There, he said.
Leia and Han looked. His mother simply swallowed hard, but his father turned away with his hands on his hips, head bowed. Jason waited while Leia composed herself, then fastened the seam again.
Did you put those bruises on her face?
I believe so.
You believe so?
Yes. Leia nodded a few times, silent, staring off to one side.
Okay, not much more I can say then.
She took the repulsor's gurney handle and moved the body back into the conservator.
We'd better be going.
Jason waited for his father to say something, but Han wouldn't even turn around. Jason went to the hatch to board the vessel they'd flown to the RV point and expected Han to relent and say something, but he didn't. Did you really kill Thrakken, Dad? Han turned and looked him in the eye, but there was no spark of recognition.
Hey, maybe it runs in the family. If I can kill in cold blood, so can my boy. I'm glad we understand each other.
Jason went to take his father's arm. Dad, don't do this.
Han shook it off.
Get away from me.
Dad.
I don't know who you are, but you aren't my son anymore. My Jason would never do the kind of stuff you do. Get out. I don't want to know you anymore.
Jason's last sight of his parents was his father turning his back and his mother standing by the hatch as the doors closed, staring at him as if she was about to burst into tears.
Dad's right. What am I?
He shook off the misery and shame as one of those weaknesses of the old Jason Solo, and reminded himself that his life wasn't his own now. His destiny was Sith. He turned the battered vessel toward the blockade, and allowed himself the brief luxury of reaching out in the Force to Tenel Ka and Alana, while he was still far, far from Lumaya.
GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Captain Shiva was swearing under his breath as he stared at a data screen in the administration office. Ben hovered in the doorway, wondering if Shiva was going to round on him, too. The officer wasn't happy.
Can I help with anything?
Are you any good at finding dead bodies? We appear to have lost a dead prisoner, and seeing as they don't stroll out of here unaided, I'm trying to find them. You can't file an incident report without a body.
Ben's stomach sank.
Aelin Haber, right?
Right. Nobody signed out the body, but it's gone. Look, why don't you go and visit your parents?
Shivu made it sound like an order. It was good to have the decision made for him. Ben wondered if the events of recent days would show on his face so clearly that his father could read them. He hoped so. He wasn't sure that he could bottle them up much longer. Mom would understand better. She'd told him a few stories about being the Emperor's hand. She'd done some bad things, she said, but it hadn't made her a bad person. Ben called first and got an automated answer. The Jedi Council was in session, so he went to the temple and waited in the archives for an hour and occupied himself looking for data on Aelin Haber. He didn't find an Aelin Haber in any public records, not even in the Kefar records, but he found a lot of Aelins and Habers. He found thousands. The size of the task daunted him, and he wondered if it mattered whether he found her or not. Then he found himself looking for the names Nalani and Brisha. He'd made a deal with himself not to ask any more questions about that missing chunk of time out at Bamil that had somehow ended with the Jedi Knight Nalani Din and a weird woman called Brisha both getting killed. How had they died? How did Brisha and Nalani die? Nalani was easy to find because he knew she was a Jedi, and that narrowed his search. But there were thousands of Brishas, too, some names, some places, and he didn't have the time to go through them all. He wasn't even sure what he was looking for, or if he would even recognize it if he saw it. He made up his mind to ask Jason when the time seemed right. Ben took the turbo lift to the council chamber floor and waited in the lobby until the meeting broke up. His parents, deep in conversation, walked down the corridor as if they hadn't spotted him, and he wondered if he had accidentally mastered the art of disguising his presence. Funny, he'd resented being invisible to grown-ups until only a few weeks ago, always ignored like a kid. Now he wanted that invisibility in the Force. But not right then. At that moment, he really wanted his mother and father to know exactly where he was, and to help him find out where he was going. He wanted to tell them how bad he felt about Aelin Haber and Jason. "Hi, honey," said Mara. She looked him up and down and wished he had changed out of his uniform. "What's wrong? Have you been waiting long?" Ben hugged her and turned to his father to give him an awkward embrace. He wasn't sure how he had to behave with him now. Most of the time, he wanted not to be just Luke and Mara Skywalker's kid. But at that moment, he was almost relieved that he was.
"Can we go have lunch, Dad?"
"Sure. Something really is wrong, isn't it?" Ben should have told them right away, but he thought about it a little more, and he was ready now. He needed to talk.
"I killed someone,"
he said,
"and I feel really bad about it."
Coronet City, Spaceport, Corellia.
Myrta was waiting for Fett when he opened Slave One's forward hatch. She didn't have a blaster in her hand, so he gave her the benefit of the doubt. He was feeling both his age and his illness right then. Dull pain gnawed at him. He ignored it.
"The Solos are bringing back Aelin's body."
"I know. I want it."
"Here we go."
"You don't have a ship, and you don't have any credits. What are you going to do with her?"
"What are you planning to do with her?"
"Bury her."
"Little late to take care of your daughter now."
"Don't you think I know that?"
Fett noted that she was wearing the Heart of Fire around her neck.
"So she gave you the necklace as a lure for me."
Myrta clasped her hand around the stone.
"No, I really did recover it."
"So what happened to Sintis?"
"Why do you care?"
"Because I loved her, and not even Aelin could possibly know what happened to us and why I left. So don't judge me."
Myrta's face was set in a snarl.
"You never made any attempt to contact them."
"You want to know what my life was like?"
"Yeah. It must have been tough building that fortune."
"My dad was killed in front of me when I was 13. I was on the run for 3 years. I married Sintis at 16 because I thought I could make my life right by doing what normal people did. But I was wrong. I tried to be a journeyman protector, but I killed a superior officer, and I was jailed and exiled from Concord Dawn. And that was the end of trying to be a regular man. After that, I settled on being Boba Fett, because I just didn't know how to do anything else."
Myrta looked at him as if she was debating whether to put a couple of bolts in his head or try a chest shot. He didn't want her sympathy. He wanted her to understand why he would have made Sintis and Aelin a lot more miserable by coming back to them after his sentence than by leaving. And he'd killed an officer who had once been his mentor, his friend. They hadn't really needed to exile him. He wanted to get as far from his pain as he could. But why did he want Myrta to understand at all? She was just a stranger he'd met a few weeks ago.
"She's nothing to me. Maybe she isn't even my own flesh and blood. Just a chance at trying to make a few credits out of me."
There was one way of settling this once and for all. He took out his data pad and accessed his accounts.
"Got a bank?"
"Why do you want to know?"
"You put the first round into Sal Solo. Take the million credits and get lost."
Her face was a mask of contempt.
"You know what you can do with your credits?"
She was family, all right.
"Got any brothers or sisters?"
"No, and no kids either."
"You're too young anyway."
"I was married. We marry young, don't we?"
"Oh, how we repeat history. I don't need this trouble. I've got enough of my own."
"So we're gonna fight over a corpse?"
"You just want to win," said Myrta. "It doesn't matter what you win."
Fett couldn't even be angry with her. He leaned against Slave One's hull and gazed up at the sky through his helmet's macrobinocular visor, waiting for the Millennium Falcon to appear as a speck in the sky and drop onto the landing strip. Myrta waited beside him, but not with him. He could almost feel the invisible wall she had placed between them. It was a long half hour. The Falcon swept across the strip and then looped back to land 50 meters away. Fett straightened up and went to meet her, Myrta at his heels. Leia Solo was first off the ship and walked toward him as if barring his way.
"I'm truly sorry about this, Fett. You too, Myrta."
Fett walked past her and climbed the open ramp into the cargo hold. Han was maneuvering a repulsor gurney into the main bay, and he glanced over his shoulder at the two of them.
"Are you going to put us back on your hit list?" Han asked. "If you're thinking of going after Jason, he's too tough a quarry, even for you."
Fett shook his head in slow, measured contempt.
"I don't have to punish anyone, Solo. Your son orders his own sister to fire on civilians and then suspends her from duty when she refuses. No, I think I'll leave you to your happy family. I got more pressing business."
He watched Han look at Leia, and Leia look at Han, and knew that he'd dropped a thermal detonator on them.
"So they didn't know. Firefack, there's my daughter in that body bag."
The silence was that heavy moment before a thunderstorm, pressing down on all of them. Leia made a helpless gesture toward the hatch.
"I can get someone to arrange a funeral for you, Fett."
"No, she's mine."
"Time for a gesture."
"She's ours."
"Okay."
Leia's voice was low and careful.
"Take it easy."
"I want to see her body."
"I don't think that's a good idea."
"Princess Leia, I said I want to see my daughter's body."
Myrta took hold of his arm.
"And I want to see my mother,"
said Myrta. Leia stepped back, but Han hovered. Fett couldn't stop his voice hardening.
"Leave us for a few minutes, Solo."
"Fett."
"I said, leave us."
Han looked embarrassed, and Leia steered him toward the hatch. Fett and Myrta were now alone in the cargo bay anteroom with the trolley. They both hesitated and made a move for it at the same time. Fett stood back for Myrta, and she eased open the cover, eyes fixed and staring. It was only the slight jerk of her chin that told him she was shocked. He stood beside her and saw a stranger. Aelin Vell's face was bruised and cut, but surprisingly peaceful. She wore a Kaffar tattoo, three black lines from her left brow to cheekbone, like her mother Sintis had done. Her dark hair was heavily streaked with gray. Myrta leaned over, placed the Heart of Fire around her mother's neck, and laid her cheek against hers. Then she straightened up and stood back, as if to give him space to take his leave of Aelin as well. And that was hard. He hesitated, because he could feel another memory, one that he hadn't suppressed and didn't want to, crowding in on him. He was in a dusty arena on Geonosis nearly 60 years before, picking up his father's helmet. Fett would have to remove his helmet to kiss her goodbye, and he wasn't ready for that, not here. He tidied Aelin's hair with gloved fingers and was about to close the body bag when the urge not to lose the Heart of Fire overcame him. It was all he had of a happier time. He unfastened it and found Myrta staring at him, grim and unblinking. She wanted it to rest with Aelin's body. Hearts of Fire had a grain, a crystalline structure that created lines of weakness that jewelers used to cleave the stones into smaller, workable pieces. Fett set the small disc on its edge and took out his blaster. A couple of hard cracks with a stock split the stone down the cleavage line, and it fell into two slices. Fett eased one piece off the leather thong and handed it to Myrta before placing the remains of the necklace around Aelin's neck again.
"Let's go," said Myrta. "We're taking her home."
"Where's home? Not Terrace?"
"Mandalore."
"I don't actually have property there now."
"Time you got one, then."
Boba Fett and Myrta returned to Slave One and laid Aelin Vell in the refrigerated hold that had been designed for prisoners whose warrant had included the word dead. It didn't feel right, but it was the only practical solution for the journey back to Mandalore. Fett made his way back up through Slave One's central hatch and settled in the pilot's seat. Myrta, still silent, slipped into the co-pilot's position.
Vivine says we Mandalorians rarely bury our dead, but I never was much of a Mandalorian.
Mama was Kiffar.
What do you want to do then?
Myrta's eyes brimmed.
I don't know right now.
Fett lifted off his helmet.
We'll head back to Mandalore by way of Geonosis, because that's where I buried my dad. Family needs keeping together.
It was the longest conversation about anything other than business that he'd had with anyone since he was a kid. It was personal, agonizingly so, and the effort hurt. He finally let the tears run down his face in silence. Myrta cried beside him, occasionally gulping for air. It was all very quiet and embarrassed, as if neither was willing to admit they could weep. But the truth was they both could, and hard. They were a family now. It was the worst possible way to forge a bond, but it was a bond, even if there was no affection. And for the first time in his life, it was one that Boba Fett would try to approach as a father himself, not as a man constantly living in the past in search of one who would never return.
Lumaya's Safe House, Galactic City.
Jason had the dream again, the one where he found himself staring at a weapon in his hands and sobbing. The dream had taken a number of forms in the last few days. In the first, he held his lightsaber. In those that followed, he held a Yuuzhan Vong ampi staff, or a blaster, or a light whip. In one, he even held a weapon he didn't recognize at all. The recurrence bothered him enough to seek Lumaya's advice. He stood at the doorway of her apartment block and looked up into the Coruscant sky to see if he could detect any light from the window. She was there, he knew. Inside the apartment, Lumaya sat meditating, her face veiled again. There was no force illusion this time. The apartment looked like any other rented apartment with basic furniture and taupe carpet, a strangely mundane setting for such pivotal events. In her hands, Lumaya held the tassels whose knots and threads were a language, a prophecy, an arcane instruction book of what Jason had to do to achieve full Sith knowledge and power. On the low table in front of her was a candle, burning steadily and occasionally guttering in a draft. I have dreams, he said. Dreams of weapons that I've used.
And they distress you, said Lumaya.
All I recall is that I'm looking at a weapon in my hand and feeling enormous grief.
It might just be a dream and not a vision.
The weapon is different each time.
Perhaps just a dream then.
I find myself pursuing the memory of my grandfather with increasing frequency. Lumaya fondled the strands of the tassels and ran the knots between her thumb and forefinger. She seemed to be reading them.
You depend on location to flow walk in time, she said. So you can only see what happened to Lord Vader on Coruscant.
Is that your way of telling me I need to find out more elsewhere?
No. I'm saying that if you look for vindication in the past, it will be at best selective.
I feel I'm reliving parts of Anakin Skywalker's life. I'd be crazy if I didn't try to learn from that.
But you already know that your path differs. He was seduced into errors. You won't be.
All right, let me ask again. What more do I need to learn to fulfill my destiny? Lumaya slowly extended her arm and held out the tassels she had been running between her fingers. He reached out and took them. They felt suddenly red hot, and he tossed them a little in the air out of pure animal instinct, as if he'd grabbed a hot breadstick from an oven. When the threads fell back into his hand, they were cold.
This is your final trial, Jason. You've sacrificed a great deal. The approval of all those who meant most to you. You've taken extreme measures to deal with those who deny justice. Now you must consider the third prophecy.
He cradled the knotted tassel in his cupped palms. He will immortalize his love. He'd turned that phrase over in his mind 1,000 times.
What did it mean?
total duty to the galaxy and no time for family? Building eternal peace at his own personal cost? He didn't know.
It means, Jason, that sacrificing your own feelings and reputation isn't enough.
What then?
You have to kill what you love.
Jason didn't quite take in the meaning of that at first. Then panic gripped him. Tenel Ka, Alana. How did Lumaya know? How could she know? He'd been so careful. He'd hardly dare even touch them in the Force because he risked alerting Lumaya to their very existence. Every visit he sneaked in was fraught with danger. But he'd been careful as only he could be. Jason concentrated hard and projected a sense of bewilderment to mask the dread and fear churning his stomach, and it took almost all his strength. He picked up the candle from the table and stared into its flame as if distracted by it, using it to focus his control. You'll have to explain that.
I can't teach you any more skills. You now have to pass through that final barrier and do what no ordinary man can. Kill someone whose death will cause terrible suffering to those who love them. Someone close to you.
Who?
I can't tell you, because I don't know.
Someone I love?
Do you love someone?
I allow myself to love many people.
Careful, careful. You're on the knife edge.
How will I know who to kill?
It'll become clear when the time is right. You'll know.
And why is it the ultimate test?
Because taking the life of an innocent is always harder than taking your own, if you're sincere. This is the ultimate test of selflessness. Whether you're ready to face unending emotional pain, true agony, to gain the power to create peace and order for billions of total strangers. That is the sacrifice. To be vilified by others, by people you know and care for, and for your personal sacrifice to be totally unknown to those billions you save. To do your duty as a Sith. To do your duty for the good of the galaxy.
She stood so close to him that her breath made the candle's flame flicker.
It's easy to be a clean-cut hero slaying monsters. There's always a little bit of vanity in it. There can be no room for vanity or pride in being despised.
Jason held his hand in the flame. He held it there longer than he had ever done before, until he smelled his own flesh charring, and Lumaya reached out and jerked his arm away. He wasn't sure if he was testing his ability to transcend pain or beginning his own punishment. He thought of his grandfather, killing simply for Padme's life. Whoever Jason had to kill as the price of being able to wield the ultimate defensive weapon of Sith order, he would know his motives were totally divorced from his own narrow wants and needs, like Tenel Ka and his Alana.
Oh no, oh no.
Lumaya took his hand and turned it over to examine the seared palm.
Now, imagine that will be nothing compared to what you'll feel when you confront the ultimate challenge.
Suddenly, Jason could see his challenge, and the prospect terrified him. He would have to kill those he most loved. He would have to kill Tenel Ka, and his precious daughter, his Alana. The fact that even the thought of it was tearing out his heart was the terrible proof that it had to be so. And still he could hardly bear to think it. The Yuuzhan Vong thought they knew all there was to know about inflicting pain. But they were beginners compared with this. How could he even think it? Jason put his right hand to his face and touched it, as if it weren't his own. He felt as if he were standing over by the far wall, watching himself die by degrees.
Is it me? Is it really my burden?
Yes, Grandfather. It's me. Jason accepted the burden in its entirety. And his heart, irrelevant, fragile, expendable, broke.
Slave One, en route to Geonosis.
So they sat in the cargo hold of Slave One, Boba Fett, Mir Tagaev, and a corpse. And Fett wasn't sure what to say next.
I never was of any use to you, was I?
Mirta said.
Does that matter?
Will I ever get to know you enough to trust you?
I could ask the same question.
You're not what I expected.
Yeah.
And you're all I've got.
There were two ways of saying that, and one was to say it like it was a last resort, and that was the way she said it. Fett wondered if his illness was affecting his mind. He heard himself say the words, going through the motions of being a normal human being.
Want to hunt with me?
Mirta looked at him with dark, pained eyes that were an awful lot older than they had been when he'd met her just weeks earlier.
What's the catch?
I'm dying.
What?
Yes, Boba Fett really is on the way out.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I'm not what I expected either.
What about fighting for Corellia?
You heard the boys. They're not interested in mercenary work when there's real soldiering to be done. I'm Mandalore, and I want to know what this Kardika has to say for himself if he thinks he's taken my job.
Oh, you heard about Kardika then?
You're the Mandalore speaker. You tell me.
Never seen him. Hearing plenty, though. What's the matter? Think he's after your Kir Bess?
The crown. The Mythosaur skull. Mirta was stroking the Heart of Fire discreetly as it sat in the hollow at the base of her throat.
Okay,
she said.
Okay, Babuir. Count me in.
Babuir.
It means grandfather,
she said quietly.
I don't speak Mandalorian. Thanks to you, I can swear in it a little.
Fett eased into the cockpit of Slave One and set course for Geonosis for the first time since he was 13. Mirta, subdued, waited for his gesture to sit up front. He'd teach her to pilot if his time held out. The galaxy would say that the Mandalorians had finally given up. Staying out of a galactic war was unthinkable. Mondo Ade had always fought. Well, there was such a thing as a strategic withdrawal, and this was one. It was time for Mandalore to put his own house in order. And if he could grab that time and defeat his illness, he'd do it. If he didn't, then maybe this Kardika would do it instead. Either way, Boba Fett was going to let the Jedi and Han Solo fight their little war without his intervention this time. Because he had more pressing business. Because Jason Solo was becoming a pale imitation of his grandfather, Lord Vader, and would take on more than he ever had bargained for. And because Fett had a granddaughter now. Family and Mandalore came first.
Good night, Dad. We're going home.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Bloodlines, by Karen Travis. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Bloodlines, is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 2006, all rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production, copyright 2006, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House audio presentation, all rights reserved.